welcome to Weed Week. I'm Alex Halpern.
And I'm Donnell Alexander.
This is the Weed Week podcast. You can subscribe to our newsletters, Weed Week, Weed Week Canada, and Weed Week California, all at weedweek.net. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Weed Week News. Subscribe and review or like us on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform.
This week, we're joined by Nikki Lestrado and Swami Titania of Swami Select. That's a flower brand located in Mendocino County. They're going to give us an introduction to regenerative farming, a trending upgrade on organic farming, and share just a few details of two truly remarkable lives.
It was a pretty fun conversation, I thought.
Oh, it was spanning the globe, I'll tell you that much.
Oh my God, I want to go. They invited us to come visit them. I really want to go visit them and hear a bit about more about their lives.
Yeah, but I want to ask you something before we get into our news item. You know, it's such a painstaking process of regenerative farming. Do you feel like in the environment that we're in, and I'm not just talking about COVID, I'm talking about the entire legal cannabis world, do you feel like people are actually going to stop enough to make regenerative farming more than just like a quirky thing that people do in Mendo, some people do in Mendo?
As with so much else, I think if consumers demand it, it will happen.
It needs a publicity campaign. I think it could be trendy. That thing you talk about cannabis consumers caring more about the behind-the-scenes stuff with their product, I think it was really tailor-made for regenerative farming.
I mean, look at how many people buy organic food. You know, same mm-hmm. sort of thing.
And we should make the point that while we talk about organic farming a bit here, it's not by any means a comprehensive conversation. It's a jumping off point. And maybe on our show notes, we'll put some more stuff in there. But first, before we get into that, let's talk about the Cannabis Distribution Association, which has begun sharing information on California companies that aren't paying their bills.
This is pretty funny, I thought. This group is basically compiling a list of companies that aren't paying their bills so that distributors can figure out who they want to work with. You know, it's almost like deputizing a posse.
What's fascinating to me about it, this Cannabis Distribution Association, is that it's only 30 businesses, 20 of which are distributors, according to Marijuana Business Daily. But there are 1,000 licensed distributors in California. This alliance, is that anything? Are they like the cannabis equivalent of people protesting on the corner? Or is this about something?
No, I think it's totally about something. You know, they're sick of stores not paying their bills. And, you know, at a time when money is tight for everybody, that really matters. So if you're a store on the wrong side of this list, I think it totally makes sense to spread the word about who's not paying their bills.
I think the line from Todd Kleppers, who works at Hardcar, he said it's kind of like an emergency network to help all the really good distributors stay aware and stay relevant. Sounds fair.
Totally. Seems fair to me.
Do you see this sort of thing reaching beyond the distribution level?
I don't see why not. Maybe in the industry, there are a fair number of bad actors. And I think that in a lot of respects, they've maybe been able to sail below the radar of a lot of people for various reasons, largely to do with the industry's quasi-legal status. So if the industry wants to police itself, that seems pretty legitimate to me.
Well, I find it interesting because I saw the quote where they're looking for the top 5 most obvious really bad players and circulating the word about them. And I see the utility in that, but I also think reputation can make you irrelevant. I mean, don't you see the possibility for abusing this?
I mean, maybe there's a possibility for abusing it, but I don't think it's being done in it doesn't sound like it's being done in bad faith.
Mm-hmm. And the fact is, I mean, I have to be honest with myself. It happens anyway. You know, people blacklist people, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about blacklisting debtors, right? It happens anyway. And business is built on it. This is what cannabis looks like today. And I guess it's part of the professionalization of the industry. But anyway, we've got these guests who go back to a different time. And I guess it's interesting that they're working in this time.
All right. Here are Nikki and Swami.
You're going to rise up singing. You're going to spread your wings. Shout and take to the sky.
Swami and Nikki, welcome to Weed Week.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah.
I have one big question. We're going to talk a lot about regenerative farming in this conversation, but I can't help but wondering from the things I've read how you got there. And I know that you came to Mendo in 2000. Is that right?
I had moved up to Mendo in 2000, and Swami came a little bit later, and we got our ranch in 2003.
But Swami, your first grow was in 1978. That's right, isn't it?
Well, that was in San Francisco up on Telegraph Hill. Definitely, I was in my little, actually it wasn't even in my yard, it was in my neighbor's side yard.
What were you all doing all those years in between? I know that you were bouncing between San Francisco and India and Asia. Were you growing? What was your life like?
You know, for me, actually, my life was about dealing marijuana, actually, in San Francisco. And we spent a lot of time in the city and in India, yes.
Well, I've said dealing was a very minor part of our life in the cities, really. We didn't, no, mostly we just bought our own flower by selling it to our friends. So, no, I mean, okay. But, you know, Nikki was actually working at various newspapers and various other things during that time. What do you want to say, Nikki?
I was a journalist, but I was definitely selling weed.
Well, that's true. That's true.
What papers were you working for?
I worked at the San Francisco Chronicle for most of the 1980s. And then I also worked at KRON-TV, which is an NBC station.
Swami?
Well, we lived in San Francisco, right in the middle of North Beach. And
well, Swami was a hippie artist.
Yeah, I was doing photography and painting a lot of watercolors and oils at that point. The late 80s, early 90s, when we were doing that. And I was also doing housing remodeling and so on. I would have, you know, photo shows and painting shows, and Nikki organized them for me.
And we both spent, we both in the 70s did go to India and overland. We both did the overland journey from America all the way across Asia to India.
How do you get overland from America to Asia?
Well, from England, from London, basically.
Not for me. I mean, okay, there was some water involved, but I took a Greyhound bus across America. I took a Russian boat across to England, and then from there it was all overland on buses and trains and pickup trucks.
I thought you were in the Black Sea on a Russian ship there, no?
No.
Okay.
I was on the Atlantic.
The Atlantic Ocean, yeah. So she went by ship from Canada to England. At that point, I had flown. My first time to India, I was working on a film called Sunseed that a friend of mine has now just reissued. And we were visiting various places in Israel, Iran, and Nepal and India, filming various holy men at that time. And then Nikki and I went, she went separately, individually.
Well, a little bit of dark history, not dark, but deep history. Swami and I met in 1969 when I was only 14 and he was an older, cool hippie guy in San Francisco. And then we got together as a couple in about 1980. And at that point, we had both already done our individual journeys overland to India. And in the 80, we got together. And that's, you know, when I did the whole newspaper thing. And he was an artist in the city. And then we dropped out again. And we dropped out together. And that was in starting around 86, we did for a bit. And then 89. And then 92, we seriously dropped out and just went back and lived in India for the rest of the 90s mostly. Although I came back to California for a bit.
How does weed fit into this? Were you growing? Were you selling? What was the culture like for you as you're making your way to the Mendo part of your lives?
For me, it was about selling it, yes, and in San Francisco. And I knew some people up in Mendocino. And actually, we were getting a lot of weed at that point, of course, from south of the border, Thailand, all of those places for a while. So we were always very involved in the weed culture. But in the other end of it. So it wasn't until 1997 when I met Tim Blake, who's now been the founder of the Emerald Cup and more. And Tim and I became fast friends. And I ended up here working with Tim on his cannabis farms starting in about 1998. And that's when I first got my hands into the soil and started actually primarily in the harvesting and trimming end of it. But I started really learning about cannabis from the other end instead of just sales in the city.
In those days, we called it ganja boot camp when you'd be up here and you'd carry bags of soil on your back under the bushes into the hidden mountains.
Oh, yeah. We were hiding from helicopters, the whole thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But see, cannabis has been, you know, of course, cannabis is what we call it nowadays. But in those days, we had so many words for it, you know, with pot, marijuana, tea, whatever. And that was really an essential part, an essential ingredient of the hippie culture and all the music that came out of San Francisco. You know, a lot of talk about the LSD and so on, but LSD trips were kind of like once a week or once a month. Cannabis, you did every day.
Speak for yourself.
Every day, all day, you did cannabis as much as you could. And in those days, in the very late 60s, early 70s, I had a live show called ESP, Extrasensory Projections, with a couple other guys. We had a lot of slides and projectors and so on. But we also, we were what was known as a holding company because there were these dealers who didn't want to stash their kilos in their apartments. So we would stash their kilos in our place. And we could take them in and out easily because we had all these projectors and so on. So that we'd take out the projectors and put the kilos in the projector boxes and so on. So. And so that our fee for the rent we charged for doing that, storing all their kilos, was we could roll as many joints as we could a day. And so we'd roll up about 20 joints every morning. And then, as we used to say, just trip around the city, pick up people, hitchhiking, go to the park, go to the beach, smoke joints and so on, hit a coffee shop. It was really, it was a very nonchalant time. But I was with a group of artists, and everywhere we went, we did drawing, we did pen and ink drawing, we did painting and so on, and photographs. And actually, I'm working on those photographs right now, pictures I took 50 years ago.
I really like that phrase, a nonchalant time.
Yeah. I know Alex has a question about regenerative farming specifically that he wants to ask, but I have to linger a little more in this yesteryear stuff. You said you were a holding company. Is that where the holding company in Big Brother and the holding company comes from?
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But see, the other thing, I just found a picture of our kitchen table with a huge bag of maybe like 3,000 or 4,000 hits of acid on the table. And we were bagging them up into hundreds again for these other people. That was, you know, that was kind of our, and I remember there was all this dust on the table and our cat Noah and licked up some of this dust and he tripped for a couple of days. He seemed to come out of it very much a Noah. You know, he kind of knew a lot more after that. And he was kind of an elder.
Wait, how do you know? How do you know that the cat knew?
How do you know? You ask Noah.
You just know him.
You just know. I mean, there was a way that he acted. That there was some definitely a different aspect about him at that point.
It sounds like you've been farming in Mendo for almost 20 years. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Actually. We really did our very first crops down at Tim Blake's place. And, you know, really, I put in one plant and we had to take it out because we had to move, right? But that was probably 1999. And then we got our place up here. We actually took possession in 2003. Mm-hmm. But our first real crop was the next year, 2004. And this old friend of mine I'd known for 30 or 40 years, he gave me all these starts, all these females, about 25 females at that point. And that was our very first crop.
The other thing is we've always grown in full sun out here because starting at that point, it was just getting semi sort of, if you stretch the rules, legal. And we decided to do that. So whereas with Tim Blake, we'd been growing, you know, under trees and very discreetly.
The manzanita bushes.
Up here, we really just took it right out in the middle of the meadow. And wow, what a difference to watch those plants grow so big and healthy under the sun. I mean, regenerative farming wasn't exactly a concept at that point yet, but we were learning constantly new things every year about how to get there.
Well, you know, since we were doing this interview, I did research a little bit about the origins of regenerative farming, if you want to get into that. But it was unfamiliar to cannabis growers at that time.
What is regenerative farming?
So what is regenerative farming? Well, regenerative farming actually is not new, but the original form of it, I think we should really call generative farming, because in the old days, 200 years ago, there were no synthetic or chemical fertilizers. And the way people farmed was using the manure from their animals on the land and so on. And so what we're calling regenerative farming is a need to get back to that kind of farming, because what's happened over the last 150 years is the what we call agrochemical farming, a big business farming. And so they use nutrients that are chemical nutrients that are, you know, derived from petroleum and various other products. And so they're very strong nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, which you always see as the typical fertilizer ingredients. And so that kind of chemical farming, what it's done is it's thrown nature out of balance. And that's what we're trying to restore when we say regenerative farming. And the history of it is, you know, of course, originally, as I said, that's what everybody knew how to do. But this very great German philosopher and educator called Rudolf Steiner sort of originated the concept, although he called it biodynamic farming. And this is in the mid-20s, 1920s. And it was in response to people who were saying, well, we need to actually get and respect the spirituality in the soil. And Greek religion and the Roman religions and all actual native religions talk about the goddesses of the earth, the goddesses of fertility and the sacredness of the soil, and that the soil is fecund and it's related to the goddess. It brings forth in birth plants and so on. And so, you know, the Romans had Ceres, the god of cereal, or goddess of cereal, and Flora, the goddess of flowers, and so on. And so the sacred nature of the soil was an essential thing, and they all had rituals based on the phases of the moon and the equinoxes and so on, that's when they would have celebrations and tribal dances and so on, honoring the spiritual nature of the soil and integrating their crops with that kind of time scale. And now that we've gotten to industrial farming, all of that kind of spiritual goddess-related thing is sort of disappeared. And that's one of the things regenerative farming is also bringing back, the nature that the soil itself is alive. The soil is a precious thing which bears fruit like the female goddess. It's the source of the common wheel, as we say, of the beneficence of nature and all of our food. And when we lose track of that, that's when we treat the soil as just an object that has to be manipulated and so on. So that's the kind of the early basis of it. And the regenerative farming then, if you want me to get into more specific details of the how of it, we can talk about the science as well. Did you want to say something, Nikki?
I thought you might want to take a breath. I could just see his face turning red from not breathing. He's talking so long. But I actually wanted to just mention that the years that we lived in India, also, we lived much of that time up in the Himalayas. And in the Himalayas, we weren't actually growing the ganja, but we were living all around it. And it was living around us because it just grows like a weed up there, that they use it for the seeds for protein. They obviously make it into chattis or hashish, which they call it there, to smoke it. And they're obviously, are they growing it regeneratively? Yeah, they don't have any fertilizers, at least.
Yeah, really. Yeah, well, what we would see when we would walk in the terraces up in the Himalayas of Kumaon and Uttarakhand were they'd be growing these gigantic plants on their compost heap outside where they threw all their vegetable scraps and so on and so forth. And keep in mind, most of those people in the mountains, the Hindus, are vegetarian people, but they have livestock. They would have water buffalo and so on. So the manure was an integral part of the whole thing.
In India, in up in the Himalayas, when cannabis was growing all around, like, who were the people who were using it? Was it seen as a religious thing? Was it seen as an everyday thing? Was it for men, for women, for who?
It was really used primarily by the men, would be the ones that would smoke the chattis, and they would gather, and that would just be like a ritual. I mean, you would even have, the local school teacher would invite you over and light up. You know, that was just what they did. The sadhus, or the holy men, of course, used it as a spiritual awakening, and they literally did wake and bake with it and then meditate or whatever they were doing all day. And the women, of course, used it for the seeds and the cooking. And so they would add that in with whatever curdies they were making or something, because it would really provides quite a bit of protein that they need in their diet, considering they're mostly vegetarian. So a lot of people would. Now, these days in India, there's a lot of young people getting high, of course. They're finally learning how to grow sensimilla. For many years, they really don't do much of that still, because when you're growing it for hashish, it doesn't matter whether it has the seeds or not. So they don't really grow the best ganja for just smoking in a joint. But there's some people starting to learn how to do that now. So the younger people in the cities are smoking it more. But it's traditionally been just every family, you know, the old guys in the family would sit around and be smoking pipes up there in the Himalayas.
Right. And then there was always use for medicine as well. And there's some evidence, some argument that in the most ancient scriptures of India, the Vedas, the Rig Veda specifically, they talk about something called Soma, S-O-M-A. And there's all these poems and praise of Soma and so on. And Soma seems to be a libation, and they've debated for many years what it comprised. But most likely it was a basis of like a cannabis smoothie, where they would grind up the flowers, add water and mix it, and then they would make a drink with it, which might have something else in it too. It might have milk, it might have sugar, honey, something like that.
Rose water.
Mm-hmm. But even also in some of these, they might add opium or something called ephedra to take mixtures and so on. But basically it was a cannabis smoothie that they were drinking. And even today they still have this bhang, B-H-A-N-G, bhang, which they have a great celebration in the spring and the fall, where whole villages will drink this liquid bhang, or they'll bake it into their pastries and so on. So cannabis is still a major part of the culture in the mountains, especially of India.
I want to get back to regenerative farming soon, but I just wanted to point out that I think, Nikki, you were the first person to use the word, or the first person in a while anyway, to use the word sensimilla on the Midweek podcast.
Yeah, bring it back.
We take it for granted that everything's sensimilla. People aren't even aware of what that means anymore. You're right, without seeds.
So I want to take it back to regenerative farming, because at this point we've talked about it a bunch, but I don't actually know the difference even between organic farming and regenerative farming. Can you let us in on some core principles?
Well, yeah, it's curious, the comparison with organic farming and the organic cannabis movement too, but organic farming started out as a very simple thing, and one of the persons who also promoted it very much was J.I. Rodale, and they had the Rodale, R-O-D-A-L-E, Rodale Institute. And they are very adamant farmers and so on. And also for your listeners, if you want to research Rudolf Steiner, just Google Rudolf Steiner with the words biodynamic, and it'll talk a lot about what their principles are. And for the same with regenerative farming, but you can just dial up the Rodale Institute. And there's also the Demeter Institute, which is their certification program. And there are many thousands of people doing that. The Rodale Institute was founded by J.I. Rodale. I think I'm pronouncing that right. They have a magazine out, you're right. And he's kind of the beginning of what we call organic farming in the United States. And also they are now also much more with his son, Robert Rodale, into regenerative farming. And so the idea of organic farming, if you look up the U.S. Department of Agriculture definition of organic, it basically says that the source of the material is either animal or vegetable, right? Which makes it different from mineral sources, and we use a lot of mineral sources in organic farming also. But organic farming is less restrictive than regenerative farming. The key principle of regenerative farming is to source as much of your product, much of your fertilizing products, products you put in the soil for your plants, you source them from your own farm to the greatest extent possible. So what are those sources? Those sources are the leaves. The sources are grass cuttings. So you make compost with those things that are right on your farm. And that then becomes part of your inputs into your soil. Yeah, you can rake up the leaves. You take wood chips. We make wood chips all the time. Also, because we have a wood-burning stove, we take the ashes and the charcoal, and that goes into the mix as well. And then we use manure, although we don't have chickens at the moment. We have wild turkeys, so we get their manure. But also we get local manure from various people. Chicken manure is specifically good, but any kind of manure is good. So you keep adding those materials to your soil, and these are organic materials. And what that does is that it starts to create the worms. The worms come into the soil. But if you go down and you go into the microscopic level, you realize that we have now soil which is alive. And it's alive on the most microscopic level with a teaspoon holding maybe 4 million bacteria, you know, hundreds of different varieties of bacteria.
I read someplace that regenerative cannabis is seed to seed, and I don't know what that means.
If you're strictly doing regenerative farming, you're not going to grow from clones, you're going to grow from seeds. Mm. And then ideally, you're going to grow from seeds that you developed and propagated and fertilized on your own land with your males coming. See, you know, cannabis has a male and a female plant. The sensimilla part is what Nikki was talking about, is separating the males from the females so they don't fertilize one another. But then you selectively fertilize from the male plants you choose with the female plants you choose. And so you create your own seeds in your own microclimate. And those seeds then are better adapted to your conditions. And then so you grow from your own seed and you select. And then at the end, you make seeds again from that year's crop that you want to keep that line of things going.
And we do grow only from seed here, yeah.
Right. Now, majority of the mass people grow from clones or feminized seeds also.
What about no-till farming?
No-till farming, and that's where you get into what the Rodale Institute's talking about. And they're talking about climate change and the crisis and the carbon dioxide in the air. And one of the key things about totally regenerative farming is we are what they call sequestering carbon. We're putting carbon back into the soil. As you put wood chips and leaves and manure and various things back into the soil, that is not carbon that normally would be either burned or go up into the atmosphere. And they have all these trial gardens and so on, and they've done this research. And they're saying that if half the cropland and pasture land on the planet were changed to organic methods of producing it, that we would actually get to a zero carbon emission without shutting down even fossil fuels. So this plants take carbon dioxide out of the air. And then also nitrogen falls to the air, to the ground in the rotting leaves and so on. So we can remove the nitrogen and the carbon dioxide from the air by using biodynamic or regenerative agriculture techniques, which aren't very different. And that then puts the soil, the carbon dioxide back into the soil, removing it from the atmosphere. So we get, and then the question is, would the yields be equal? And they've also shown that the yields with total regenerative farming practices are actually superior to either chemical farming practices or organic practices that are done in the conventional tilling method. When you till the soil, to get back to that specific question, you actually release carbon dioxide and nitrogen, which is stored in the soil, and it loses out into the atmosphere, so the plants can't get it. When you don't till, all those bacterial life and the fungi that are key to storing the carbon are left in the soil, and they grow and they get bigger and bigger and better and better. So tilling the soil is probably the worst thing you can do, and no-tilling keeps all those biological things alive in their area of depth that they thrive.
The regenerative techniques are not necessarily, and certainly haven't been necessarily, widely used by cannabis growers, even in the Emerald Triangle. Can you talk a little bit about what it's been like using these practices in Northern California when much of the market doesn't?
Well, back in the old days, people just threw Miracle-Gro on their crops, and you were growing under these trees and you didn't have a whole lot of sun, and you had to really boost it up to make that happen. And people weren't aware. No one was aware of it then. That's what we all did. And it started changing. When did it start changing, Swami?
Well, I don't know exactly in the cannabis world, but see, the Rodale Institute, to get back to, they have this thing called Community Supported Agriculture, CSA. And some of the local farmers up here started to get involved in CSA. But CSA, you know, you have to use regenerative methods to be part of that. So actually, there's a group called the Dragonfly Earth Medicine, And it's Josh and Kelly, and I always forget their last names, unfortunately. And they've created this thing called the DemPure Regenerative Certification. And they're actually having, we're having a Zoom meeting tonight to actually come up, what is the definition of regenerative farming for cannabis growers? Now, you asked about the majority of cannabis people now are trying to get, they got dollar signs in their eyes, and they're growing indoors, or they're growing in greenhouses, and they're using clones, or they're using feminized seeds, and they're using all these fertilizers that come from industrial products, and they are delivered more or less as salt, so they're easily absorbed. And they have a huge carbon footprint of just the lighting and the water purification and the air conditioning and so on. And, you know, all of these methods are kind of contrary to the most basic principles of agriculture. Now, they feel that they're feeding the masses and so on. But I feel, and I've been, you know, people have argued against this, but I feel that it's inferior cannabis. It's actually such a different product. It's not really cannabis. If you get cannabis that's grown with total regenerative methods in the full sun for the long season with no light deprivation and, you know, pure in the ground, then you're getting something that's not only an expression of the place where it grows, but it is better. It's better for your health, it's better for your stone, it's better for your high, and it's way, way, way better for the planet. And there is a small movement of regenerative farmers for cannabis who are actively meeting and actively spreading that message. And it's one of the most important things that we feel that we're doing to change the world of agriculture to get to something that's not destroying the earth, destroying the fertility of the earth, but restoring the fertility of the earth. That's the whole point, and reducing the carbon emissions.
The average customer out there wants to know exactly what they're going to get, and it's going to be the same the next time, exactly the same. And that's what encourages people to grow with clones instead of seeds, to grow indoors and all these things, to have really, you know, controlled growing sort of atmospheres. It's the connoisseur that really appreciates the regenerative grown cannabis that's always going to be unique. Each time it's going to be different and a little special. That's for real the connoisseur taste.
In California, I know there's been talk about this, but is there any certification system right now so that customers can know if they're buying regeneratively grown cannabis?
There are several certification systems. One is actually called Biodynamic. It's from the Rodale, but it's called the Demeter certification, or Demeter, Demeter, goddess of fertility, I believe, in Rome.
And as a cannabis farm, you can get that certification?
There's one certification for cannabis, which is from the Rudolf Steiner Biodynamic School, and that's called the Demeter Certification. And there are people who actually go around and visit your farm and certify it. And it's not just about how you grow your cannabis. It's about your whole operation and how it's harmonic with the environment. Similarly, we have this DemPure certification, which is a regenerative agriculture certification, created by the DemPure Dragonfly Earth Medicine, Josh and Kelly. And we just had several meetings, and we have an annual meeting and so on. There's also Living Soil People. And then there's Brother David, who has from David Bronner, which is called Earth and Wind, I believe, or something like that.
So there's several certifications, and the California state government's also coming up with an organic certification that's available, too.
And the other one is Clean Green Certification, which is a regular organic certification similar to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And we're also certified with that. That's your standard organic certification. But he also looks at how your operation is with your drying, and that's sanitary and so on. So there are these several certifications, particularly DemPure and Clean Green, which are telling the people that. And then also now in California, all cannabis for sale has to be tested, so you know that it's pesticide-free as well.
What's next for Swami Select? What do you have going?
Well, actually, being an essential business has been a big deal that we've been deemed, you know, we've gone from outlaws to essential in just such a short time right now. We're still getting used to that idea. And where Swami Select is, you know, we do a lot more than just sell beautiful flowers. We also love doing education and really sharing insights to people and helping people that are just getting involved in cannabis in the first time as well as people that have been in it forever. But it's all about, you know, the education to change the stigma. We're very involved both journalistically, we write a lot, and politically in our local politics, and any way we can to just break down that stigma that people have still in this world about cannabis.
Yeah. Well, we're involved. We have this Sheltering with Swami YouTubes on video. Previously, we had Smoking with Swami, but now since we're all sheltering...
Well, we can't have the guests here anymore, yeah, so it's just us.
Right. And also, they've been sort of discouraging the smoking stuff. So we have a thing we call Sheltering with Swami on YouTube, and we try and put up something once a week at least. And we kind of reminisce about cannabis issues and talk about things like that. We also, I'm involved in a group called Origins Council. I'm one of the founding members of the board there. And we're proposing Appalachian status for cannabis based on the legacy growers of California, about 8 different areas which are legacy growing areas. And we're working with the state of California to create rules and regulations for the use of Appalachians, just like for wine. You know, Nikki talked about connoisseur use of cannabis, and we want a way to guarantee to a connoisseur that if it says it's grown in the Emerald Triangles, it's grown in Mendocino, it's grown up on Bell Springs Road, that the certificate on there guarantees to the consumer that, yes, this is indeed the real stuff, the best flower in the world from up in Bell Springs. And that will be an appellation system which will protect the consumer.
And actually, what Swami Select is really up to right now is it's springtime. It's a glorious spring here, and no virus is going to stop farming from happening. So we've got the little baby seeds are sprouting in the garden, and we're preparing the new garden for the season. And, you know, we're off to a new year of making wonderful flowers for people to enjoy.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us. That was pretty cool. Very round-the-world trip.
This is really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us onto the show. We really appreciate sharing this information with everybody. Keep up the good work, you guys.
Yeah.
All right. We'll talk soon.
That's our show for the week. If you'd like to give us feedback, go with hello@weedweek.net. We'll respond. But before we move on to the end of the show, I want to deal with Alex's weekly social media nugget.
All right. So this tweet comes from Grant Stern. That's at Grant Stern. And he works with Scott Dworkin, who's a Democratic activist and podcast host, and I was on his podcast, The Dworkin Report, this week.
Yeah, you were great.
We'll include the link in our show notes. But anyway, the quote from Grant Stern, at Grant Stern, is, "Did you know that cannabis is considered an essential industry in most states during the hashtag coronavirus pandemic? I didn't either. Learned that and a lot more from interviewing the founder of Weedweek News. Hashtag happy 420.
Can I tell you why I find this amazing? And it's not just because you were really good on the episode. I found the truth in the replies, you know, because these are not like our hardcore weed aficionados and industry people. These are just Democrats around the country responding. And I just felt like there was so much earnest interest. And I don't mean this insultingly, but they don't know that much. And it made me think we are so essential. I didn't intend to use essential that way, but that's what we are, because there's a hunger for news about what we're going through. I want to pat you on the back for reaching those people.
Oh, well, thanks so much. Hope we do. For lots more weed news, you can subscribe to our newsletters, Weed Week, Weed Week California, and Weed Week Canada. They're all free at weedweek.net. Make sure you enter our contest to win an autographed copy of my book, The Cannabis Dictionary. It's one of Forbes' most recommended books about weed. We're going to be holding a weekly drawing for a signed copy, and you can enter by signing up for one of our newsletters at weedweek.net. And if you're this deep into this episode, you should subscribe and review or like us on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever it is you happen to be hearing us. I'm Alex Halperin.
And I'm Donnell Alexander.
Our show is produced by Donnie Alexander and engineered by Larry Buell. Alicia Beyer wrote our theme music. We'll see you again here next week.
Later.
Bye.